Sehr geehrte Teilnehmer und Teilnehmerinnen, ich möchte Sie zur heutigen Ringvorlesung des KH-Eberle-Projekts Gemeinsinn herzlich begrüßen. Um auch unsere internationalen Gäste einzuschließen, werde ich die Vorstellung des heutigen Referenten wie auch die Moderation in Englisch durchführen. It is a distinct honor and a great pleasure to welcome today's speaker, Dr. Gruia Badescu. Gruia Badescu is an Alexander von Humboldt Fellow and a Zukunftskolleg Research Fellow at the University of Konstanz. His research has examined the relationship between architecture and dealing with a difficult past, particularly in post-war and post-dictatorship contexts. One focus of his research is urban post-war reconstruction, particularly in former Yugoslavia and the Middle East. His PhD, conducted at the University of Cambridge, examined the relationship between the reconstruction of cities after war and the progress or process of becoming of coming to terms with the past, with a focus on Belgrade and Sarajevo. In 2015, Gruia joined the University of Oxford as a departmental lecturer in human geography and later became research associate. His project examined processes of memorialization of sites used for political violence during the military dictatorship in Chile and their transnational dimension, linking them with Southeast Europe. In October 2018, Gruia joined Jan and Alida Assmann's Balsam-Preis research group in Konstanz, Reconstruction Memory in the City, and in 2019, he started his Humboldt Fellowship. His project deals with the syncretic placemaking and cosmopolitan imaginaries in the European city. In 2020, he became a research fellow at the Zukunftskolleg of the University of Konstanz, with a project on urban imageries after political ruptures. His publications have examined urban memory in post-war and post-authorian contexts. He is the co-editor of the volume Synchronous Pasts, Transforming Heritage in the Former Yugoslavia, to be published in 2021. And he is now completing a monograph tracing the relationship between architectural reconstruction and dealing with the past in the 20th century. He is the co-convener of the Memory Space and Place Working Group of the Memory Studies Association. And without further ado, Gruia, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Philip, for the kind introduction. And I will just share the screen. So thank you very much for joining today. And so we have heard in this lecture series about a number of scales of Gemeinsinn, of communal sense in this project. We heard about the scale of the nation. We heard about sports, about schools. And what I'm going to do today is going to open a different direction and take you to cities, and to, not only to cities, but also to this process of placemaking. So we have heard, we have heard a lot about cities being the hope for new political projects, for being new ways to engage with big questions of the society. This has been a discussion for decades now, and this has also been connected with understandings of different communal forms of living. One of these approaches has been described as a new municipalism, and one of the cities that is dealing with that is Barcelona. And we have here a quote from Ada Colau, the famous mayor of Barcelona, coming from this important movement of the Barcelona en Comú, so in common, again, important word for our topic here, who says that we're living in extraordinary times that demand brave and creative solutions. One of these extraordinary situations was the migration crisis, as it was depicted by the media in 2015, in which the city of Barcelona, as many other cities around Europe, decided to actually circumvent the national mechanisms of dealing with refugees and created different programs and different forms of integration and offering services to the incoming migrants. And so we see here that cities have offered a hope. And since then, there's been quite a lot of academic work on the institutional mechanisms, on all these social processes, and all these initiatives to actually include more voices and include, let's say, elements of diversity into the way that cities are being run. But what I want to do today is to move away from this approach based on institutions and on programs, and to talk about cities as places. So to what extent can we actually talk about cities and placemaking practices in cities as ways of contributing to new and inclusive forms of belonging. And of course, and this is connecting to what extent can placemaking practices actually contribute to Gemeinsinn? So I define here Gemeinsinn in the way that you did bio building on the translation of Karl Schutte of Kant's work of Gemeinsinn as communal sense. So to move away from other other understandings. So that's for those who are not familiar with the concept. It's we're looking here at how do we build a sense of a community of the we formation as you did bio talks. And what I'm going to do today is. I'm going to take you to a couple of cities. First, to a city where there's a global discussion now about how will we live together, and that's Venice, the host of the Venice Biennale. Then we're going to talk about the broader questions, and then I'm going to take you to Sarajevo and discuss syncretic placemaking and discuss the promise and the discontents of this, and then opening up to other inquiries in other spaces. So, first of all, let me take you to Venice, where at the end of last month, there was the opening of the big Venice Biennale. In case you are not familiar, Venice hosts two sets of biennales, the Art Biennale, which is older, and the Architecture Biennale. And the Architecture Biennale was supposed to be last year, but because of COVID, the COVID pandemic crisis, it was opened just this year, and it was opened basically a month ago. And the topic of this year's Biennale is how will we live together? And this brings together about 46 countries with 116 representatives who are answering to the call of Hashim Sarkis, the Lebanese curator of the Biennale, of this question. And the main point of this Biennale is that we need a new spatial contract. So this is a call for architects to imagine spaces in which we can generally live together. So this is the main claim of this year's Biennale. And I must say that the Biennale usually discusses a lot of questions related to architectural form. It's about design. But this year, following up on this 2016 Biennale, it addresses this very social question that is of relevance to our conversation here. And so the theme is again how we live together, and as they claim, how is about the process, and also saying that architectural thinking is about problem solving, will is about the future, we is about the actors in this case architects working together with other people. To live is not only to exist, but it's to thrive, to flourish, and together it's about the collective, the common, the universal value, but also as we can connect to a theme Gemeinsinn. So this is the connection between the political and the spatial, of course, has a long history. Since Aristotle, we heard that the city is the spatial expression of democracy. Then you had various thinkers from Rousseau to Rawls bringing different spatialities in connection with democracy. And so the architecture of the sharing culture has been a preoccupation for a number of thinkers. But what is happening now is that, as the Biennale manifesto argues, is that this generation has a different condition. It works in, as you can see here, it's almost a postmodern manifesto by saying that it's unlike previously ideologically driven generations. Now there's no consensus, there's no single source. So the plurality of sources and diversity of answers were actually in which are living together. So somehow it doesn't talk about the grand narrative, it talks about the plurality of narrative. But one thing is certain for the manifesto is that that we're discussing here, that a spatial contract has to be the basis of the social contract. So as, again, Hashim Sarkis highlights, the spatial contract is at once universal and inclusive, an expanded contract for peoples and species to coexist and thrive in their plurality. And of course, the question is, to what extent can architects, because this is, after all, an architecture biennale, to what extent can architects help us project the future? And particularly in considering the challenge of climate change, but also of the various facets of diversity we are seeing today. So I will now quote from the manifesto. Above all, we have become increasingly aware of the global dangers for spatial practices, including transportation and environmental controls. But we continue to live as if alone on a passive planet of endless resources. To paraphrase from the singer Prince, yes, they do this, we continue to party like it is 1999. And Hashim Sarkis argues that it's no longer the time to wait for politicians to propose a path for a better future, and that architects should actually take initiative and get involved in this process of rethinking living together, beyond the family house, beyond things that are connected with what he says as their obsolete forms of living. So the various curators of national pavilions or of various offices that were invited are doing is they're trying to figure and map different ways in which locally or nationally this idea of living together has been approached through design, the common in the community. Some go further and they map forms of working together by various groups in which they produce spaces together. The Philippines pavilion is quite spectacular in mapping globally various ways of working together and proposing that for architects to actually work together with its communal ways of making spaces and going just beyond the agency of architects. Others produce architectural shapes and forms that bring together different traditions and try to communicate visually. So we can see a number of approaches, but this is not one. I want today to talk about the richness, but also the many problems that occur in this biennale and how actually the rather coherent call is met with a rather haphazard solutions and going into very different directions. I want to focus on one of the questions that emerges in this biennale, and this is how will migration shape architecture? And so this is a question that it's that has been explored this year, but also has been explored particularly in 2016, the first such biennial that dealt with social questions. And that was called Reporting from the Front, curated by a Chilean architect, Alejandro Aravena. And in this case, a number of countries responded to the 2015 events in Europe. And so this idea of how do we build cities in connection with increasing diversity, in connection with various forms of temporary need, but also planning for uncertainty, that was something that was quite important at the time. Germany, in particular, devoted its pavilion to making Heimat Germany a rival country, discussing various ways of dealing with increasing diversity in German cities and making an ode to informality based on the famous book of Saunders, Arrival City, in which cities are seen as the way to move forward. Cities are seen as the way to emancipate people coming from a variety of contexts in cities of the global north. Well, if we are now to bring together the big questions is, and these are the questions that are the big threads of my research as a Humboldt fellow here at Constance, is how do architects and city makers respond to this increasing diversity in cities, but particularly to this impact of the displacement and migration. But then also, what is the role of spatial practices in placemaking in shaping communal spirit in places of such diversity? So this is how, to what extent is this idea of placemaking important? And bringing back to the Reconstructing Memory in the City platform is, how do we create this link between placemaking and memory practices in cities of diversity? So the main focus of my research is practices to which architects and city makers respond to these urban transformations. And in this case, after forms of displacement, after conflict, how do they deal with these memory practices and to include concerns for diversity? So it's a question that can fit in many contexts, but what I want to do is to actually take you to a context that maybe you're not thinking when we're thinking about let's say Western European cities dealing with the increasing diversity, and trying to decenter the question by going somewhere in the near abroad, not far away, but which can help us see patterns, but also challenge some of the hopes and practice that we see at the moment. So I want to discuss today cities with cosmopolitan imaginary, cities of diversity, and this experience of migration and displacement through particularly the city of Sarajevo. So you might wonder, why am I taking you there? Well, just bear with me for trying to introduce a couple of threads about this this particular city. So what we see here in this urban image is an image of a public space and conviviality, okay, in a very masculine form, as you can see. But in any case, this is the main trope existing in the discussions in Sarajevo is about the city of openness, a city of conviviality, of neighbors always saying hi first to each other and then to the sun. But also, it's a place of a spatiality that might evoke, just looking at architecture, ideas of coexistence. So we can see here from minarets to the towers of a Catholic church to the towers of an Orthodox church. Of course, this can be interpreted as coexistence and living together, but as Robert Hayden points out, it can also be a landscape of antagonistic existence. So basically of kind of building towers higher than the neighbor out of spite. So these two imageries, in fact, of coexistence and antagonism define the city. But the question is, to what extent don't they define every city? So this Sarajevo has been called the Jerusalem of Europe for this diversity. And it's interesting how today Jerusalem is associated with other things, and Sarajevo as well. So what's important to point out is that in at the level of the construction of this of its elite's understanding of the city, but also the everyday understanding of the city before the war and to some extent after the war, the city is seen as a cosmopolitan and open city. So this is a place where people of different religions have coexisted for centuries. And this is the main trope of the idea of being the open city where everyone can fit in somehow, or this is at least the claim. And this is also part of the various monuments from before and after the war. In this case, saying that the multicultural person will build the world. Yet Sarajevo is also known for the war of the 1990s, in which the city was under siege for more than 3 years. This is the longest siege of a capital city in modern history. And this is a moment of destruction. Among other things, we see here in the image the former National Library, in which most of the archives and the books have disappeared in the fire after the Bosnian Serb paramilitary shot at the building. Yet this particular episode has been described not only as an example of what ethno-national conflict means, but locally has been explained in a rather different way. This has been described by a number of architects, Bogdan Bogdanović of Belgrade, but also Ivan Strauss of Sarajevo, as an attack against what is common life. Bogdan Bogdanović, in his text, talks about urbicide as a particular way of destruction of the city for being a city, for being a place of diversity, for being a place where all these people of different faiths come together. The destruction of the National Library of Sarajevo is then seen as the destruction of culture, but also of places of coming together. The fact that the attackers shot at squares and at political institutions, but also at these cultural institutions, for Bogdanović is a proof that they just wanted to attack common life. Of course, you can look at the other way and say that this building somehow for the paramilitaries would be somehow associated through its architecture an Islamic form of architecture, and that would be a reason for ethno-nationalist targeting. But this is not the main trope within Sarajevo. In fact, if you look at the discussions today, is that this understanding of the city under siege by the peasants of the hills, who did not understand the common life of this diverse community, and they attacked it exactly because they were living together. As Radovan Karadžić of the Bosnian Serb forces described it, this is a Sodoma and Gomorrah of mixing. So mixture and common living seemed to have been under siege, at least under this particular theory. Well, if we are to see the city today after the siege, we see basically a divided city with a main city of Sarajevo as we see here in north of this yellow line. And then this yellow line means the division between Federation Sarajevo and Eastern Sarajevo, which belongs to the entity of Republika Srpska. So Bosnia today is divided between these two entities, which are very loosely connected, and they're rather antagonistic in their politics. And the city has some form of division within. And this division also means that a lot of the sites that, for instance, are on the border between the two are being completely not taken care of. Also, in this image, we see the Vraca Memorial Park, which was a memorial park of the fight in the Second World War of the Sarajevans of various faiths against the fascists. So it's an anti-fascist monument typical of former Yugoslavia. Well, this today is looks unkempt, and it's basically in a state of ruin, a sign of its border situation, but also of the fact that it refers to a communal memory of a common fight against fascism, which is not necessarily embraced. There are other forms of memory that took over, and basically this is the memory of the 1990s wars that are more important. But if we had to look at these landscape of diverse architectural elements belonging to different faiths, what we see in the production of space today is that we see on the one side in the Federation, where the majority of population today are Muslims, we see the construction of mosques. On the other side, you have Orthodox churches, and then you have some Catholic for the small Croatian minority. But basically, in this case, we are getting to this point that architecture in reconstruction is somehow intentional. And in fact, through reconstruction, you reshape the landscape, but you also bring a form of violence, a symbolic violence, a cultural violence, by actually appropriating space for one group. And this has been called in different ways, and we can maybe discuss later about these forms of violence. But, and this is done also with the aid of actors from abroad, as we can see here, a mosque built by the Saudi state. There are a number of Islamic states kind of building different mosques as a sign of fraternity for the Bosnian Muslims. But on the other hand, as is being commented locally, as also a sign of paternalism. And as we can see here, the big Saudi complex is next to a neighborhood which is still not being repaired after the extensive damage of the siege. And this capital is reshaping the city, and as we can see here, a shopping mall in the city center built with Saudi from a Saudi project with Saudi money. And as many of the locals in my 1 year in Sarajevo were mentioning at the time, this is they feel that the city is being taken over and by these international forces, and somehow with this very bland and internationalist forms of architecture, the office buildings of Dubai, etc. However, when I was doing this work in Sarajevo, there were some local architects, and now we finally go back to architects and how they respond to this, who said, well, we don't want to really just play with what this new political economy of client-based, investor-based, Saudi-based command, but we want to do something different and actually refer to the condition of the place, the condition of diversity of the place. So for instance, Studio Nonstop discusses this office building as not only just an office building, but as an attempt to create a Balkan puzzle, to express the form of diversity and the dilemmas of the Balkans, which are not really a clear shape. Well, more into the local character comes the approach of Amir Bugzets, who is an architect who is quite celebrated by some architectural critics, but otherwise rather unknown in Bosnia Herzegovina and abroad. He in his work, he's trying to bring together all different elements of what this city and all these different histories and memories how they shape this the space. So in this example of the cultural center of Meitas, we see how he brings together some Ottoman forms, as we can see this doksat. We see some transparency and orientation from the street. This is an Austro-Hungarian built area. So he brings together this historical epochs, but also different Bosnian architectural elements, the inner courtyard, the called Avlia. But I will not bore you with more architectural specifics, but I want to focus on what he's actually saying, how he's explaining his process of design. He says that this is a duty of people who work in such complexity. So he says this is heterotopic. So of course we can think about Foucault's heterotopia as a form of resistance somehow. He says this, he's born in the city which has the east and has the west, has the cathedral, has the church, has the mosque. The atmosphere is changing. And he kind of makes an ode to postmodernism by saying that only in Las Vegas you can have this. But this is historical, he says. So this gives an opportunity for people to feel comfortable in all its parts. And then he says this: I like to say that my architecture is like the dish, the Bosnian pot, Bosanski lonac. This is a dish in which you put a number of things together, and you let them boil, and it needs a lot of time, and you have to put everything to work together and wait. Maybe in architecture, this is also a recipe. So somehow, in something that evokes some older tropes of the melting pot, he's offering here a local understanding of how to produce this kind of spaces. And I call this syncretic placemaking, which I define as a process of drawing from multiple traditions in a diverse place like this to create a contemporary architecture celebrating diversity in memory and identity. And in this case, I followed the anthropological work of Stewart, who is talking about syncretism not in the traditional way that is connected solely to the religious practices, but it's connected to any form of practices that refer to mixture and diversity. And there are so many concepts running around about mixture and diversity, Stewart argues that that syncretism is the one way to look at practices that are both about proximity and convergence without the loss of cultural characteristic. This is not forms of assimilation, and this is not hybridity. This is something else. So syncretism somehow offers this prospect of convergence while remaining. While evoking this elements that went in. However, there are many critics of the original use of syncretism, and it's not the moment to discuss, but we can talk maybe later. But I see syncretism as in this anthropological understanding as an interesting hope also for the process of placemaking. And this is also echoed by now I'm focusing on the North Macedonia Pavilion of the Venice Biennale, in which an Albanian minority from an Albanian minority in North Macedonia has created this pavilion, which was actually contested because of its in Macedonia by more nationalist forces because of its connection also with Islamic architecture, but basically in which he's blending in, and he talks about that every element in this structure is actually of a different size, evoking somehow the differences existing in a society, but together they create a structure in which one can actually have a communal use. So this is also a way of spatializing this. But what's interesting in both these cases of Sarajevo or this pavilion is that the architect is proposing a design that is supposed to evoke this idea of diversity, hope, and common living. And the architect is the main actor here. So now we have a number of challenges. On the one hand is that these architects think that they're proposing solutions for having more layers and more diversity into evoking this plurality in memory and identity. But to who reads this? So this, we're getting here to the dilemma of reading architecture. And Frederick Jameson, the culture critic, famously talked about allegories and how basically interrogating whether we can have something like fascist architecture. He would argue is that only if we look at a building, for instance, in Rome, the Eur building, we can say this is a fascist building, because we know that there was something called fascism during which this building was built. But to what extent can architecture be fascist? The same thing is, to what extent can we understand that, for instance, Amir Bouzet's architecture refers to multiple layers? You need initiation. And this maybe it's a far-fetched comparison to talk about Michael Hirschfeld's cultural intimacy, but you need these forms of intimacy with various structures of the place, which the local will have. But then this is connected with the second question. So who are we drawing from? Who is creating this placemaking approach? Who is heritage? What do we do with the newcomers in the moment in which we are building this on memories of the of particular parts of the past? If we, I am to take you back to Sarajevo, after the war, about 100,000 people came as internally displaced people from what is today Republika Srpska and started living in Sarajevo, building informal housing. This is something that is happening all throughout the world. In this case, the hills of Sarajevo were built with this informal housing, which led to a lot of disgruntlement in the lower city, so in the city of the old city, let's say, including the socialist city, with the old Sarajevans, so people who were born in Sarajevo, saying that these newcomers have ruined the city, have ruined the landscape, and without really an empathy for what they've been through, but also some of them suggesting that it's a continuation of the rural attack against the city, because through these architectural monstrosities, as one of my interlocutors said, this is a way of suffocating the city below. But beyond these accusations, what is interesting is how do we connect these particular to the legacies and the experience of these newcomers to the attempt of to express the let's say the genius loci of Sarajevo or of a city of diversity. To what extent is that diversity only connected with the past layers, and how do we work in what was missing from these discussions was actually the way of co-working and co-production of space. And what we see here is remember the how these cities look at themselves, be it today's cities welcoming refugees or Sarajevo traditionally as a cosmopolitan city, but what we see here is forms of exclusion also in practices of placemaking. So I'm proposing also interrogating this concept of exclusionary cosmopolitanism. To what extent are these cities practicing different things that they preach? And so something here is about including this, these voices. And to broaden up a bit the discussion, there is this hope also coming from human geography in the discussions of how to create what Doreen Massey calls progressive sense of places, in which new diversities and voices are included in the sense of places liberated from connections with only the past, which some parts of society will see it as stagnant and nostalgic. And then you have this idea of throat togetherness and how by bringing together the various aspects of the city, new and old, various social universes, you can get something there. And this is this idea of the happenstance juxtaposition of the city is quite important into how you are together and how you are discovering the city. But the key here in human geography is how do you produce space and how do you open up the production of space. So one way that, for instance, some city makers and architects have tried, if you look, for instance, at the example of Copenhagen, and because of COVID, I wasn't able to go there yet to conduct interviews. And I've been before some preliminary work, but just to mention that there was this project in a few years ago to create a park in a neighborhood of Copenhagen, in which basically all the representatives of the neighborhood coming from various migrant backgrounds will feel somehow at home. So the designers assume that basically if every community will have a couple of people who would work together with them to actually bring something that is recognizable, and from there they will create a space that somehow would even speak to this concept of syncretism. We can see here a Moroccan fountain. You can see here, these are actually Romanian chairs based on the Brancusi model that Romanians will immediately, it's assumed that it will immediately recognize, but I tested and it's not the case. But in any case, this is, again, an architectural intervention that in typical Scandinavian way was very hopeful and very, and also rather uncritical of the process. But the question is, to what extent can design work? And this, at least, the fact that members of these groups were involved in this process, this is at least a step further to actually open up the production of space. So I want to, because this is an ongoing project, I want to now to have some preliminary remarks. First of all, this syncretic placemaking, comes from an heterotopic architectural practice that I identified in a city that's dominated by otherwise nation building and tension making. A city in which you have different platforms and definitely not a communal idea for the city, but rather divisive identitarian platforms. However, there was a hope of this identification of architectural way of engaging with living together through forms of understanding the past and bringing people together. But what the issue of voice remains lacking. Architects, as in the Venice Biennale, I want to go back to Hashim Sarkis' point that politicians are failing, therefore we architects should come and intervene. This is something happening for a century now, that architects, for instance, had a reaction with the modern movement to social inequality, but the modern movement also created cities that many people are unhappy with. So the question is, to what extent are we in the same place how can we actually open up the production of space and placemaking to all these different actors and to actually not only talk about consultation, but talk about participation in the production of space, including even the ones who are in cities like Sarajevo undesirable, like the informal settlement dwellers who are at the margin of society despite being so many. And so this is only through, and going back to the Philippines Pavilion, through actually mapping these forms of communal space production. So be it the Gotong Royong of Indonesia or what we see here in the images, and actually understand how communities, again, this is a problematic term, but how groups work together also to produce space, and then that can be the role and a possibility for architects to cater and to work together rather than design, assuming that people will get it somehow, will get what they wanted, their intentionality. And finally, this is also what I'm trying to do here is also to say that even if we look into places that we associate with conflict, we can find horizons of hope. And remember, Sarajevo was also a place that experienced not only out migration, but also the issue of displaced people arriving by having limited budgets, and how do we actually deal with this, but also of people coming back, particularly if you remember Germany gave only 3 months at the end of the Bosnian migration, war-induced migration in the 1990s. After the end of the war, it gave 3 months for people to return to Bosnia, and many of them returned, others went to other countries. But basically, the experience of Sarajevo in a place where people returned is also very important for us to understand how cities in various countries that are affected by wars today can fare. But going back to the European cities, I think that syncretic placemaking and looking at also these practices from the Balkans can actually create some potential for dialogue into not only reinventing the wheel in Scandinavia, but trying to actually create a transnational dialogue of practices in which the issue of voice should be taken more into consideration. So thank you for your attention. And now for the ELA of my excitement. And also in Bosnia, hello, I'm from Nepal.
So thank you very much for that interesting presentation. And I open now the floor for questions.
Leida?
Yeah, thank you so much for this really very, very concrete presentation of what is possible and what has been achieved and what is still in a state of experiment concerning placemaking. We have focused here certainly on place and space, but there were also references to time. And I would like to talk a little bit more about this relationship between space and time. It came up in one case, which I found very interesting, and this was that every architecture needs time to be inhabited, adopted, changed in the use. So this cooking metaphor, it needs to boil, and I found that a very important hint. And the other reference to time had to do with the idea that buildings themselves represent time, and that they are markers of symbolic epochs or cultural features. And so I wonder how you bring these different ideas about time in place together, and perhaps you could elaborate a little bit more in this direction. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eliza. This is a very important question about what some would say regimes of historicity you bring into the architectural production, and also maybe just to on the one hand is how architectural production relates to time. Is we have to make also this big distinction between the modern movement in which there was a war to the past. So that meant basically we are looking at the future, at the present, with the progress of technology, and we can build cities in which we don't care about the past. We are building for a more just society. That was the original idea, and then it got a bit derailed. But in any case, there was the idea of the past reference was never there. And then in the 70s, you had all these disgruntlements with this way of doing this, of making the city, so the Charter of Athens, the Le Corbusier model. And so this is how the postmodern thought appeared. And postmodernism produced originally this return to the past in as a form of pastiche, as kind of playful, but then basically the return to heritage and all these turn to heritage and memory in the process of architectural production was very important. And that was received in different ways by different people, but it's definitely that time appeared and history re-emerged in the way we look at things. Sometimes they even go to the more radical, like the example of Poundbury in the UK. I don't know if you're familiar. It's Prince Charles supported this project in which there was a village built with buildings that would be looking old. And so it wasn't a reconstruction as in the case of Germany, but it was something because Prince Charles argues that we need to refer to the past. So this is maybe the more radical version and radical in the word radical in a different direction. But now the second part is how you started, Alaida, by talking about the time in which people, in which space is appropriated and becomes a place. Because of course we know that in geography, this whole discussion of space is abstract and place is concrete. And so place is also a space in which people associate with memory. Place also with memory and also the experience of living. In this case, this idea of co-production of space is can also be in the moment when people inhabit. Can actually inhabit the. Sorry, I'm getting. I see these messages and I'm getting. Inhabiting a place, it's also a form of co-production. So it's not only the co-production of design, but then people adapt. Or for instance, you have this famous example of when you do parks and designers don't always draw the alleys because they let people go and choose the pathway that it's more direct. And then they realize what is the best way to arrive in a place. And then the designers come in. Make an alley there. So it's kind of, this is another way of co-production, of waiting and seeing and seeing the way of producing space. I hope I answered it a bit. Christiane.
Thank you very much, Guia, for the very, very interesting talk and about all the impressions from the Biennale and from the development in the cities. And my question is, what's about the money? What's about financing all these wonderful ideas to make a better living together in the cities? It's a question, and that's the money, and who is building, and how can it work that many, many people are engaged in this building of their own city? And the other about the ecological needs, how to think about, is it really a good thing to build new buildings or how we handle our limitations? So they are a bit on the other side, but maybe I think it's also a part of the discussion.
Yeah, thank you very much, Christiane. So on the one hand, who is supporting this? So there are cities and municipalities that actually are encouraging this. And I start with Barcelona, and the plan is to finally go this autumn to Barcelona to the very much postponed work that I was supposed to do as part of the Balsam project, but because of the, and then not the Humboldt, but then because of the pandemic, I couldn't go. So Barcelona is sponsoring this kind of projects and looking at different ways, either through programs, but also through spatial ways to actually create a more inclusive environment. I gave the example of Copenhagen. So sometimes you have this support by the local authorities. Other times you have some intervention from private companies that know that it looks good as corporate social responsibility, but it's still not the most sexy topic compared to others. Like, for instance, the environment is way more appreciated by CRS today. But much of this discussion in the urban field is also about somehow pop-ups and things that happen on their own. That you don't need a lot of money. You need somehow forms of small interventions that then go, as it's called tactical urbanism. And then you go and they develop and they take over a city. So this is also something that we'll look at less finances. But what we actually see is that the power of capital and the example of Sarajevo, I was giving the example of the Saudis, who come and they shape the city through their capital. It's really not going towards this direction. For instance, even if you look at spatial practices in all these buildings that the Saudis have supported in Sarajevo, you're not allowed to buy pork, to consume alcohol in a city that was before the war, had a relative majority of non-Muslims. So it's also the money also determines some forms of usage. While most Bosnians back in socialist Yugoslavia, they were consuming alcohol, for instance. But capital brings also an imposition of certain social practice. But now going to the environment, as I started with the Biennale, this is one of the main directions of how do we live together. Also, looking at the climate crisis. I didn't go into that direction because this is something that it's quite research and quite. It's a very important topic. But I'm more interested in my work about this issue of cultural diversity and migration in cities, and particularly post conflict. However, this is the red thread, and this is very important, and this is. Somehow, also it was a cry for help in the biennial by saying, okay, we can live together only if we are taking into consideration the climate. And some of the pavilions addressed that, but still the biennale went in very different directions, and the climate didn't really emerge, nor migration as something that dominant. It was still going in different places. How do we live together? It's obviously still an open question. Anna.
Hi, Kuya. Thank you very much for the lecture that I'm listening now from Berlin. And I wanted to ask something that is a bit far from the main issue that you were addressing, like about cultural diversity and identity. I wanted to ask if you relate your research also to the question of social infrastructure. Like, I mean, you said that, I think in your initial question was how architecture can somehow solve or give solutions to the problem of social polarization. And I wanted to ask if you're also looking at the broader question of the decline of civic life, which is also, I mean, became more severe during the pandemic, obviously. And I mean, this brings back the question of money, of course, because social infrastructure is something that should be provided by the state or by the community. And my impression was from the projects you introduced that they were more artistic had this more, let's say, not... It's unstable structure in a way. I mean, there were exhibition artifacts, some of them, and looked very much experimental. And I'm asking for the question of how to make these infrastructures more sustainable in a way.
Yeah, this is actually the Biennale usually introduces this ideas, and it's maybe one of the most important architectural events, if not the most important in the world. So a lot of attention is what is being done there, and there are a lot of experiments. But also there were for instance, companies that were presenting some new materials, etc. And so some of them and will already go on the so-called market. But basically, this idea of the civic life, and particularly after the pandemic, the big challenge of this was that most of this content was produced before the pandemic, because this was supposed to be open last year, in April, and because of the pandemic, it was open a year later. And very few pavilions were able or willing to actually redo everything to consider the pandemic. So I think that will be the next platform to think about what is the impact of this on the civic on the civic life. But the issue of erosion of the civic, for instance, I think the Austrian Pavilion discussed that also in various ways in which there's a loss of civic life, and this idea of how we live together was connected also with this democratic deficit that is happening in many places right now. So trying to urge architecture to also create spaces, to create agoras, let's say. But this is kind of the easy way to say that, okay, we're going to do the agora. This is since Aristotle, we need places for people to come and to do politics. And there was a while ago, there was this discussion of Tahrir Square in Cairo. If you actually look at the movement in Tahrir Square, you see the spatiality of it, and you see that actually there are all these elements, how people organize themselves. And then you can actually urge designers to do this, to create places that are better for civic action somehow. But I think the idea of space of encounter, this is something that's very important, both in the Biennale and also in this production. And the examples I gave, from Sarajevo to Copenhagen, they're actually about places of encounter. They're cultural centers, they're open spaces. So this is a way of actually getting to civic life. And going back to this, to Gemeinsinn. So on the one hand, you can see this idea of the communal spirit in connection with particular collectivities, but also the communal spirit of the city, in which you create an infrastructure for these processes to happen. Yeah. In any case, no, thank you very much. And if you have any other comments, we can write an email, auch auf Deutsch, ich werde das versuchen. And also, yeah, I actually have to present the book that we just published on heritage in from Yugoslavia to the Memory Studies Association. So we have there's another meeting. So in case there's no more questions, we can continue the conversation next time or via email. Thank you so much for the attention in this very Zoom crazy time. People I know are very tired of this, but I hope that we can continue also live and next week. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Guya.
Thank you.
And for all of this. Thank you. And Fräulein, the best for you for the presentation now. Und bist du da jetzt auch mit dabei, Guya, dann bei der Präsentation von Fräulein?
Nein, ich habe gerade gesagt, dass ich um sechs habe ich einen anderen Vortrag, also für nicht Vortrag, also ein Roundtable, und wir werden über unser Buch über Jugoslawien reden. Also das Buch erscheint, also das wird jetzt im August veröffentlicht werden.
Hat sie jetzt verstanden, dass sie das zusammen gemacht hat?
Ja, nein, das ist.
Hat es mit ihrem Verlass.
Es gibt, ich glaube, jetzt 1 Million Zooms jeden Moment. Ja. Das ist das Problem.
Echt.
Ja. Aber auch, es ist gut, dass es wird aufgenommen. Das ist
ja. Es ist wirklich schon ein Austausch, wenn wir irgendwann mal wieder uns richtig sehen können. Wenn man das nicht mehr nur und dauernd hat, sondern in einer Mischung, dann wird es, glaube ich, echt, dann kann man es echt auch wieder genießen. Denn eigentlich ist es ja toll, ne? So ja. Von Berlin und Tübingen und Konstanz mal. Und Frau Haller, wo sind Sie gerade?
Jetzt hört man mich.
Ja, ja.
Ich sitze in der Universität Konstanz im Medienzentrum.
Ah, okay.
Und habe ein kleines Zimmerchen. Ah. Es ist sowieso niemand hier. Ich habe ein kleines Räumchen, wo ich eine Kopfhörer brauche.
Sehr
Vielen Dank für den wunderbaren Vortrag. Wenn ich doch noch etwas sagen darf, wollte eigentlich nicht. Ich habe ja 5 Jahre in Sarajevo gearbeitet, unmittelbar, als der Krieg zu Ende war. Und es hat mich vor allem angesprochen, wie diese Stadt wieder, das vielleicht einfach ein Input, weil ich es vergleichen kann, wie diese Stadt wieder hergestellt worden ist, verglichen mit vor, wann war das, 96, verglichen mit vor 25 Jahren, das ist unglaublich. Ja. Es ist fast nicht zu glauben, wie das jetzt wieder anders aussieht. Ich weiß nicht, ob es in den Seelen der Leute auch so, ob da auch so vieles wiederhergestellt ist. Aber nochmals ganz herzlichen Dank für den interessanten Vortrag.
Vielen Dank. Vielleicht nur ein etwas kurz. Es gab so einen Architekt von den USA, Lebeus Woods, der ist am Ende des Krieges nach Sarajevo angekommen und hat gesagt, ja, wir können ein Experiment machen, diese Architekten mit konzeptuellen Experimenten. Also ja, wir lassen die Ruinen und wir können wieder aufbauen, aber jedes Gebäude soll also ein Teil wie Ruine, also wie eine Wunde bleiben. Und die Leute waren total dagegen, haben gesagt, nein, wir haben genug gelitten, wir möchten nicht jeden Morgen in einer Stadt mit Wunden leben. Und deshalb glaube ich, dass die Stadt ist so wieder aufgebaut. Und zum Beispiel, wenn man nach Belgrad fährt, kann man Ruinen mit der Stadt sehen. Und das ist auch, weil diese Ruinen eigentlich die Erinnerung an den NATO-Bombardement erinnern sollen.
Also das ist eine andere Geschichte.
Genau. Also für die Leute in Sarajevo, das war so ein Trauma, diese 3 Jahre, die möchten nicht mehr. Und jetzt gibt es sehr wenige, nur diese Bild von Hochhäusern mit, also Wohnhäusern mit Lücken. Aber das ist am Rand der Stadt. Auf der anderen Seite in Belgrad ist das Gedächtnis durch Ruinen sehr wichtig, politischerweise und ja.
Dabei gibt es im alten Jugoslawien, also im früheren, ich weiß nicht, ob Sie auch andere Städte angesehen haben, Split zum Beispiel. Das ist die Stadt, wo jedes Haus hat ein bisschen römische Ruine drin. Also dieses zeitliche Zusammenbauen in der Architektur ist etwas, das eigentlich dem alten Jugoslawien, das frühere, das war sehr vertraut. Aber gut, das ist jetzt ein anderes Thema.
Ja. Ich hoffe, dass wir bald reden könnten. Also jetzt
ein anderes Mal.
Präsentation, ne?
Ja.
Vielen Dank.
Vielen Dank und schönen Abend noch.